TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Bringing Down Civilization. This is the second part of a talk by the author of The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, and Listening to the Land. The setting for the talk was the cavernous warehouse of AK Press in Oakland, California. The place was packed. Every seat was taken, and people and bicycles were leaning against the outer walls. Jensen's talks are always improvisational and non-linear, with a lively give and take. In part one, Derek Jensen had laid out his provocative statement that we are so close to environmental collapse that we need to consider taking down and dismantling civilization before civilization destroys the capacity of the earth to support life. He had ended with the powerful image of our grandchildren sitting hungry on the banks of the Columbia River, cursing us because we did not have the courage to remove the dams that killed the salmon that once ran so thick that horses were afraid to step into the water. In this part of his talk, he begins by acknowledging and describing the anger his demand to take down civilization has caused. Here is Derek Jensen.
I gave a couple talks up in Eugene a couple years ago, and there was two of them the same day. And there was a woman who hated my talk so much and hates my work so much that she came to both talks so she could attack me. And I admired her persistence. And what she did is she at both talks, she accused me of being a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin. And the reason is because I want to deindustrialize. And because I also said that humans have exceeded carrying capacity. And I don't think that overpopulation, by the way, is a primary problem. I think overpopulation is a tertiary problem. Overpopulation, which is not to say there aren't more people than the planet can support, but the reason it's not a primary problem is because more important than overpopulation is overconsumption. So the important thing is ecological footprint. This is really important because when we think of overpopulation, the first images that come to mind are usually little babies of color with big bellies. But when you think of overconsumption, first thing you think of is some asshole in an SUV, and who actually is causing more damage to the planet. So that's why it's not a primary problem, but a secondary problem. Oh, by the way, also, I love to say this. I say this whenever I'm in California. It's a big deal. There's some of the right-wingers say we need to close the border to Mexico. We, by the way. It's like, who's we? The border needs to be closed to Mexico. And I always say, yes, actually, I agree that the border should be closed between Mexico and the United States on one condition, which is that you also close it to resources. Because if you believe that the resources should come up, but the people shouldn't, that means you're just a racist who wants the coffee that's grown on land that used to be theirs. Because they don't come up because they are unhappy with their spouses, but not to the point in therapy where they can actually say something to the spouse. And so they have to come up here for an eco-tour of the strawberry fields of San Joaquin Valley. They come up because their community has been unraveled. Well, actually, that's not true. They come up because their land's been stolen. I mean, let's just cut to the chase. Anyway, so it's a secondary problem because consumption's more important. And it's actually a tertiary problem because there have been many cultures that have existed in a steady state. I mean, the people lived in what is now occupied Tutnes, that's where I live, in occupied Talawa homeland. Human beings lived there for at least 12,000 years, if you believe science, and if you believe their own stories, they lived there since the beginning of time. And they did that in part by not overconsuming and not overpopulating. And so there is a mindset that leads to this behavior. The point is that she was upset because I want to deindustrialize, and let's be really honest, deindustrializing is going to kill a lot of people because the entire industrial agriculture system is based on natural gas and oil. And if you take down the natural gas and oil infrastructure, well, the people in the third, the rural people in the third world, I think, will be much better off immediately. Rural people in the United States will be okay. Urban people, I mean, like the rich people in cities in the United States, I don't care because they're a problem anyway. I go back and forth on how things will be for the urban people of the so-called third world, because on one hand, sort of food shipments would stop flowing in immediately, but on the other hand, food shipments would stop flowing out immediately. And also, talk about instant land reform, just stop giving the rich people of the third world guns, and the poor people are going to suddenly discover they've got access to a lot of land. It's an interesting question, and I mean, the truth is, every cell of my body wants for there to be a voluntary transformation, wants for us to sort of ease off, or them to ease off, or whatever, and for there to be this soft landing, and for people to suddenly get smart about population and consumption and all that, but it ain't going to happen. Okay, so on one hand, if you actively work to bring stuff down, there's a lot of people who are going to suffer, die. If you don't actively work to bring stuff down, it's going to come down eventually, and then there's going to be a lot of people, a lot more people die. So it's like, what the hell do you do? I get to like page 400, and I can't go on because of this woman's question, which I mean, I don't agree with the Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin thing, but she raises a good point. And then finally, I came up with an answer. Is Becky Tarbottom here, by the way? Okay, because she, I actually stole the answer directly from her, and so if she was here, I wanted to give her credit. But if she's not here, then I came up with it all on my own. Anyway, if you've gotten this far in this book, or if you're anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably have nothing to say to each other. How about them Red Sox? We probably also agree that this crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to support both humans and non-humans. If you agree with all this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, that civilization is going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my talks and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert them to neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, or especially in the city, so these people won't starve when they can no longer head off to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams, and we need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to protest and to chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All of this can look like supporting traditional, local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. And it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, those people growing medicinal plants do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who have chosen that work. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so f***ed up is that no matter where you look, there's great work to be done. Do what you love. Do what you can. Do what best serves your land base. We need it all. This doesn't mean that everyone taking out dams and everyone working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goals. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places simultaneously if possible. The work of renewal must be local. I have a new phrase, dismantle globally, renew locally. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they will thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. This doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas or that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what will work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It is contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We can even do our work side by side. Okay, so I'll talk about hope for a minute. Several years ago, a friend of mine called me late one night. She's an activist, works on pesticide issues in Northern California. She called me late one night and said, you know, this work is so hard. It's so painful. It's killing me. I said, yeah, I know. I can do that. And then she said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does, even itself. She said, unless it's stopped, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. She said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. She said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? I thought a moment, and then I said the thing I knew all along was the best thing I could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason I said that to her is because about 10 years ago, I was having a similar breakdown. I was just bursting into tears, three or four times a week over the salmon, grizzly bears. I mean, you name it. And a lot of my environmentalist friends would tell me, you know, just back off, Derek, take some time off, because the problems will still be there when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. I knew that if you're not going to cry about the death of the salmon, what are you going to cry about? You know, if tears are to mean anything at all, it kills me. I was in Colorado last week, and I'm sure you know this, that black-tailed prairie dogs are getting hammered. Black-tailed prairie dogs will live next to the interstate. You know, if they are that adaptable and they're still getting hammered. So anyway, one day, you know, I was just breaking into sobs. I knew I had to keep pushing. And one day, I called my friend Jeanette Armstrong. I said, you know, this work is just, sometimes it's so painful. And she said, yeah, I know it is. And I said, you know, the dominant culture hates everything, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does, even itself. And I said, it has a death urge, doesn't it? She said, yeah, it does. I said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? She said, yeah, it is. And then I said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And then she said the best possible thing she could say, which is, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best possible thing she could say is because it normalized my despair and let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation and let me know that the sorrow is just sorrow and the pain is just pain. And it let me know it's not so much the sorrow or even pain that hurts as it is my resistance to it. One of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they co-opted rationality and they co-opted hope. And the way they did that was by making it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Would you rather move to a ghetto, reserve, reservation? Would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Would you rather get on a cattle car? Would you rather resist, possibly get killed? You want to go in and take a shower? You want to resist and possibly get killed? But I'll tell you something very interesting. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a higher rate of survival than those who went along. Remember that over the next 10 years. One of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father was because there weren't battered women's shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason that she stayed with him was because of the false hope that he would change. False hopes. We'll get to hopes in a second. False hopes bind us to unlivable situations, and they blind us to real possibilities. I mean, does anybody really believe that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? Does anybody really think that Monsanto is going to stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? False hopes. False hopes. Another thing, by the way, that keeps us tied to unlivable situations is I've heard a lot that we should never take out dams because that'll actually hurt the river more than leaving the dam stand. And that's such bull. And I was talking to some fisheries biologists about that. It was so funny. I would call them up and I would say, so if somebody were to blow up a dam, would that actually hurt the river below it? And hello? Hello? It took me a couple, three tries to figure out I had to sort of mask the rhetoric. What I eventually said was, okay, so let's pretend that it's 2015 and the oil economy has collapsed and the electrical infrastructure has collapsed and the people in your community have some explosives and they are asking you whether it would be in the river's best interest to remove the dam, recognizing this is 2015, it's a long ways away and it's theoretical. And when I gave them that out, oh my God, it was so cool. They were like, oh, blow it. Blow it. Yes, absolutely. Now. And, you know, rivers dam all the time, you know, with landslides, with lava flows, all that. That's part of a river's natural process. And then the dam breaks. And every time, I love this phrase, every time it creates, and also, you know, a river is not this area between the banks. I mean, a river, if you look at it in terms of a river's own natural history, they writhe like snakes. You know, they're all over the place. The thing that the fisheries biologists were saying that I just loved was that every time a river changes its course, every time it breaks through a dam, it causes short-term habitat loss, long-term habitat gain. And, okay, the reason I love that is, like, that's it. That's why we stay in shitty relationships. That's why we stay in jobs we hate. That's why we don't bring down civilization. That's why all this stuff is because we're afraid of the short-term habitat loss so we don't get to the long-term habitat gain. About 18 months ago, I was in Colorado, and I was giving a talk, and I was bashing hope, and somebody in the audience said, so can you define hope, please? And I said, oh, I've been bashing it for years. I don't even know what I'm talking about. And so I did what any self-respecting person would do, which is I turned it back around them and said, so, smarty pants, what's your definition? And he came up with a great definition. Actually, the whole audience did. It was great. I mean, they were like bouncing out back and forth off each other. The definition they came up with, was hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. Because I don't hope that I eat something tonight. I don't hope that I sleep. I'm going to do it. The car was shimmying all the way down from Crescent City, so I do hope that I make it home. And it smells like burning rubber, too. This is very bad, 350 miles away from home. So anybody knows about cars, let's talk later. That actually wasn't a joke. Okay, but the next time I get on an airplane, I hope it doesn't crash because I have no agency. And so what hope is, fundamentally then, if you accept this definition, which you don't have to, but under this definition, hope is an acknowledgement of your own powerlessness. So I don't hope that coho salmon survive. I will do what it takes to make sure that they survive if they don't like the way they're being treated and they want to go extinct, I will say goodbye and I will miss them. But I will not allow the dominant culture to drive them extinct. I don't hope they survive. It was so cool. When I was at Mill Creek yesterday, there were the two salmon. One came by earlier. One other one came by right when I said that. It came right up next to the, it's a pretty small creek, and it came right up next to the bank, moving very slow. It was a huge salmon, and opening her mouth wide and closing it. And I was thinking, okay, either she's saying, right on, groovy tunes, man, or she's saying, coho, what about the Chinook? Can we talk about the Chinook for a second? I think she was saying one of those two. Okay, so now we will read this, because this is a really sweet thing to end on. And of course, after talking about the apocalypse, you do have to end on a happy note. Pretend you're a river. Pretend you are the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pox and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water and more, in pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You are the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You're the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You're the pressure who pushes water through seams. You're the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You are a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You are the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You are the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall who turns water to air and air to water. You are the mist who settles on the soil. You are the plants who drink the mist, and you are the sun who warms and feeds them. You are the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You are the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who flow down the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a new river who is all the rivers and something else. You are the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river who is married to the mountains you have known since they were young, who have given themselves to you as you have given yourself to them. You are the canyons you nestle into, each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees, the meadows you flood and feed, and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who with their own bodies again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That is who you are. That is who you have always been. You are the river. You have lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You have been dammed by lava and ice. You have carried log jams so large and so old that they grow their own forests, with you running beneath. You have lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forests. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the humans. You are the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you, as you have done forever, and as they have too. Now, pretend you are a forest. You are the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You are the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who become owls, who become slugs, who become shrews, who become soil. You are the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You are the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You are the wind who speaks through the trees and the trees who speak through the wind. You are the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You are the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold. And you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the people, the humans. You want them all back. You need them back, or you will die. Thank you.
You heard the second part of a one-hour talk by the young environmental writer Derek Jensen. I recorded him in November 2004 at the Oakland, California warehouse of AK Press. Derek Jensen is the author of many books, among them The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, Listening to the Land, The Other Side of Darkness, and Strangely Like War. He co-wrote with George Drafin, Welcome to the Machine, Science, Surveillance, and the Culture of Control, and The Global Assault on Forests. Vandana Shiva wrote the foreword. Derek Jensen has a very interesting website at www.derekjensen.org. Derek is spelled D-E-R-R-I-C-K. There you can find a list of books that he likes and dates of appearances and classes. There's also a discussion club around the theme of bringing down civilization. There is a link to Derek Jensen's site on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs page. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete one-hour talk by Derek Jensen by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. For information on how to order, you can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.